The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Kentucky Representative James Comer pushes FBI Director Wray for cooperation on documents related to an alleged pay-to-play scheme from the Bidens.
The investigation is not dead. This is only the beginning.
We'll talk to Virginia Representative Ben Klein.
Congress will continue to do its duty to hold Mr. Wray in contempt.
And Andrew McCarthy.
Comer's sound position was that he said the briefing they got from the FBI raised more questions than it answered.
Ohio's Jim Jordan weighs in on today's FBI.
There are 278,000 reasons to be concerned.
And after three more Republicans announced their candidacy for president, we'll look forward to the debates with RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel.
Nobody's going to get on the debate stage unless they're committed to supporting who the voters choose.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. Follow me, please, on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. We'll begin with Congress and Kentucky Representative James Comer's efforts to get cooperation from FBI Director Christopher Wray, as Comer looks into a whistleblower's account of an alleged bribery scheme.
FBI officials confirmed that the unclassified FBI-generated record has not been disproven and is currently being used in an ongoing investigation. The confidential human source who provided information about then-Vice President Biden being involved in a criminal bribery scheme is a trusted, highly credible informant who has been used by the FBI for over 10 years and has been paid over six figures. These are facts, and no amount of spin and frankly lies from the White House or congressional Democrats can change this information. At the briefing, the FBI again refused to hand over the unclassified record to the custody of the House Oversight Committee, and we will now initiate contempt of Congress hearings this Thursday. Given the severity and complexity of the allegations contained within this record, Congress must investigate further. Americans have lost trust in the FBI's ability to enforce the law impartially and demand answers, transparency, and accountability. The investigation is not dead. This is only the beginning.
Ben Klein represents the people of Virginia's 6th Congressional District. You join Andrew Wilco, my colleague on the Salem News Channel.
For the lay people, what does that mean, contempt of Congress? What happens and what weight does it carry?
Well, a contempt proceeding, very similar to if you're found in contempt in a courtroom, can be accompanied by penalties. And if prosecuted by the appropriate entity, can result in anything from fines to jail time. So what you have here, however, is an individual in the administration, and if found in contempt, it would be up to a different arm of the administration, the Department of Justice, to prosecute. And so that's highly unlikely, but it has happened in the past, and so Congress will continue to do its duty to hold Mr. Wray in contempt next week.
Here we have what is being described as a credible source that sort of adds to what we know about the Hunter Biden laptop. Money was flowing from China, Ukraine, and other countries to shell corporations, then out to various members of the Biden family, including Hallie Biden, who, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't actually do anything. And there was allegedly 10% for the big guy. What we're also getting is that some of this might be a direct pay for play related to American foreign policy.
It's amazing the scope and the complexity of just the allegations in this one document. And so we owe it to the American people to get to the bottom of it. The press, of course, won't pick it up. The mainstream press will try and ignore it. It's up to us to bring out the facts. We will not stop. And, you know, it's the sitting president of the United States, for God's sake. It's his family that is potentially benefiting from changes in administration policy. We owe it to the American people to get to the bottom of it. And we are not going to stop until we do.
I mean, kind of funny. We're all on indictment watch for President Trump. We haven't heard anything in quite some time about this investigation into Biden's document handling. I mean, my God, we learned that he had documents that he had taken from the skiff when he was a senator. That's how long he's been doing this. We get nothing.
Well, we've known that Merrick Garland has had a partisan agenda for some time, and we know that individuals in the DOJ, in the FBI, have been pursuing partisan agendas. While the rank and file may be law-abiding citizens working to uphold the rule of law, there are rank partisans in the FBI, in the DOJ, working to pursue an agenda to help their side and to target conservatives.
What do you think would happen if we had the receipts? We have Hunter Biden's laptop. This document and others may show us a pay for play. I mean, that is literally one of the things mentioned in the Constitution in Article 2, bribery, treason, high crimes and misdemeanors. We were told by the Democrats that Donald Trump could be impeached for conduct before he was president when he was a private citizen. We're talking about a $5 million pay for play scandal that involves the sitting, well, the then sitting vice president, now president. Would Republicans say if there was enough information, well, that was before he was president, we can't do anything about that?
Well, Jim Jordan is no shrinking violet. So I can guarantee you if the evidence is there, Jim Jordan will lay it out for the American people and we will follow the facts where it leads.
How's this all going to play out? Andrew McCarthy is a seasoned, trusted analyst. The former federal prosecutor joined Joe Piscopo on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
Will Merrick Garland ever allow this to happen?
Well, he can't stop Congress from holding him in contempt, but you're right to wonder what's going on behind the scenes between Ray and Garland. And what people need to understand, I think, is that the FBI is a component of the Justice Department.
Yep.
So Ray answers to Garland, and it seems to me that it would be impossible that Ray would be taking this position with Congress unless that was the position Garland wanted him to take. So he knows that he's not going to be prosecuted by the Justice Department. Now, I think to Ray's credit, he doesn't want to be held in contempt. So he has been trying to come up with ways to, you know, give Congress enough that they stop at least saying that they're going to hold him in contempt. It sounds like Comer is not going to be satisfied with anything less than the production of the document, you know, in a way that gives it to Congress that, you know, they don't have to rely on the FBI to see it. So far, you know, Ray has only shown the document to Comer and to Raskin, who is the head Democrat on the committee. And the FBI hasn't let them keep a copy of it, didn't let them take notes on all of it, because apparently some part of it is now classified, according to what Comer said last week. And what Comer is saying is, look, the subpoena says you have to give us a copy of the document. We need the document. We don't want to be minded by the FBI while some of us get to review it. And I don't think Ray would have taken that position unless Garland had backed him.
Interesting, too. And I'm thinking, how is Comer being picky here? Because apparently Ray did let them see this email, but he didn't deliver it himself. Correct me if I'm wrong. And therein, because that Chris James Comer said about Chris Ray, he's got to bring it in himself. And Ray did not do that. So he's like Comer sticking to his gun, saying, well, we asked a specific way to be delivered, and now we're going to hold you in contempt. Is it because of that, Andy?
I really hope not, because that would be, you know, what Comer has to worry about, Joe, at this point is he wants to be firm without looking like he's being petty. So, you know, he kind of won last week because Ray said you can't have the document.
Exactly.
And then he says you have to come over to the bureau and look at it. So then last week Ray brought it over. Well, Ray didn't bring it himself, but he had FBI agents bring it over. It shouldn't matter to Congress. If all they want is the document, it shouldn't matter whether it's Ray who hands it to them or somebody else. And he sent over agents who could give them a briefing about the document. And I thought Comer's sound position was that he said that the briefing they got from the FBI raised more questions than it answered. And the other thing that Comer doesn't like, and I don't blame him for this, is if only he and Raskin get to see it, then what will happen is what happened last week is Raskin goes out to speak after Comer speaks, and you would think that these two guys were not at the same briefing and that they didn't see the same document. So, like, great, Comer's like, okay, we have to do this. We need the document so that we can, like, see what it really says and satisfy people about what it really says. And we want to have a situation where we're speaking to people in public so that they can know what the actual deal is, not so that, you know, Jamie Raskin can come out and, you know, spew a bunch of nonsense that sounds like him and Ray were not in the same place even.
James Comer, with whom we began our coverage of these allegations against Biden, is chair of the House Oversight Committee. Ohio's Jim Jordan sits with Comer on oversight. He's also chairing the key subcommittee on the weaponization of government. He spoke about today's FBI with Bob Franz, my colleague in the Buckeye State, from AM 1420, The Answer, in Cleveland.
How would you define the state of the FBI right now? And how quickly do you think it must be, I don't know, dismantled maybe is a good word. We don't want to destroy it because we need it, but dismantled it and rebuilt in a better way.
There are 278,000 reasons to be concerned. That was the report 3 weeks ago that said 278,000 times the FBI queried the database in the FISA process and was getting information about Americans they should not have been able to get. That's the reason. That shows how serious the problem is. When James Comey was there, he got a memo. This is straight out of the Durham report. He gets a memo from the intelligence community that says, it looks like we have real intelligence, credible intelligence that says, it looks like this whole Trump-Russia thing is a made-up matter coming directly from the Clinton campaign. There's a memo that's sent to Comey. Comey doesn't share it with the agents. He doesn't let the agents on the Crossfire Hurricane see that memo. You got to be kidding me. That's straight out of the Durham report. So this is why John Durham has done the country a service. I understand some people are still, you know, and I get it. No one's being prosecuted that they think should be. But the facts he points out and how bad that investigation was, how wrong it was, how it did not start with any proper predicate, and then they did things like I just described where they didn't even share critical information with the agent. This one agent, when they interviewed him, when Durham's team interviewed this agent who was on Crossfire Hurricane, they showed him that memo, and they asked him if he had he seen it. He had not seen it. He read the memo. When he got done reading the memo, straight out of Durham's report, he got up. He became visibly upset, emotional, gets up, walks out of the room, comes back in and says, I did not see that memo. I should have seen that memo. That memo could have changed how we did this whole investigation. That's how ticked the guys, the good people who do the cases were that information was kept from them.
Coming up, as more candidates throw their hat into the ring for the 2024 contest, we'll look forward to the debates with RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel.
Nobody's going to get on the debate stage unless they're committed to supporting who the voters choose.
In the next segment of the Town Hall Review. Stay with us.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy celebrates our 25th anniversary year, please watch our new promotional video based on Ronald Reagan's 1976 radio address, Shaping the World for 100 Years to Come, on our Pepperdine SPP YouTube channel. And if you know someone who's thinking about graduate school this fall, we welcome applications at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. That's publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The list of GOP contenders for the party's nomination for president got longer this week. On Wednesday, former Vice President Mike Pence made his announcement.
President Joe Biden and the radical left have weakened America at home and abroad. In many ways, our country has grown barely recognizable than just a few short years ago. There are crises everywhere, and it'd be easy to stay on the sidelines. That's not how I was raised. That's why today, before God and my family, I'm announcing that I'm running for president of the United States of America.
As did North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum.
To unlock the best of America, we need a leader who's clearly focused on three things: economy, energy, and national security. And that is
And that is why today I'm officially announcing I'm running for the President of the United States of America.
The day before, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie made his own announcement.
So I'll say to you tonight that I can't guarantee you success in what I'm about to do, but I guarantee you that at the end of it, you will have no doubt in your mind who I am and what I stand for and whether I deserve it. And that's why I came back to New Hampshire to tell all of you that I intend to seek the Republican nomination for President of the United States in 2024, and I want your support.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
With the field getting crowded, the Republican National Committee has set the criteria for participation in the debates and the details for the first of the cycle. Fox News will host. It will be in Milwaukee on August 23rd. I turn to RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel. Former President Trump, former Vice President Pence just dropped his announcement video. Governor DeSantis is in. Senator Scott is in. Ambassador Haley is in. Former Governor Christie dropped his announcement yesterday. Vivek Ramaswamy's been in for a while. I think those seven will get the 40,000 minimum donation. Not sure if Governor Hutchinson will, maybe. Doubt Larry Elder will, and he's my colleague. And North Dakota Governor Borgum, not sure he will, and I don't think anyone else will. Do you think the field is fixed at those 10 serious candidates, seven of whom are likely to make the debate stage?
I think we've got the field pretty settled now as who's getting in. I think everybody understood. If I'm going to have to get a $40,000 small dollar donor base, I'm going to have to get in before August. So I think that field is mobilized, and I think we've created good criteria. And the reason why we've done this 40,000 small dollar donor threshold, one, the Democrats had 60,000, but the Democrats have a better ecosystem at small dollar donations. And if our candidate is going to be anywhere near competitive with Joe Biden, they need to start creating this building block towards the success. And we need to make sure that they have a small dollar fundraising infrastructure. And that's why we're putting this requirement in. If you can't do this, you really shouldn't be running for president. You're not going to beat Joe Biden. So we're not doing it in a punitive way. We're doing it in a success metric. And if you can't do this to get on the debate stage, you're probably not going to be able to take on the incumbent president of the United States.
Do you have settled in your mind or within the committee yet how you will raise the levels for participation eligibility in subsequent debates?
Yes, yeah, so we did put in this first debate criteria out that the debate criteria probably or will, we left the margin, increase in subsequent debates. And the debate committee, Dave Bossy runs the debate committee, and it's made up of RNC members. We really feel strongly about that. We haven't settled on that threshold yet. We want to see how this works, and we want to watch and see what this does for the candidates and who can make it, and then we'll settle on that. I will say also, Hugh, the polling criteria that we've put forward is really sound polling criteria. 800 likely Republican registered voters, not just adults, not just any registered voters. So we're really narrowing in on only Republican primary voters, which is something the RNC has never done in the past. And I also think it's going to help make polls more accurate with the way we've created this criteria.
You know, what I've always said is that the debates ought to be about the 30 million Republicans who vote in the primaries or the caucuses. There are 30 million from 2016. Maybe that number is up. Is that the guiding principle for the RNC, Madam Chairwoman?
It is. And it's also a big reason why we put this pledge in, Hugh, the Beat Biden pledge. Nobody's going to get on the debate stage unless they're committed to supporting who the voters choose. It is about the voters. They get to pick the nominee. I don't get to pick the nominee. You don't get to pick the nominee. Republican primary voters get to select the delegates that eventually pick the nominee. And every candidate on that stage, we're asking them to show respect for their choice and their decision-making after this process is done, and pledging to support them, because what do those voters want the most? They want to win the White House, and they want to beat Biden. And that's why that's part of our criteria as well.
Now, there are no secrets on the show. I want to be a part of this debate process, and I've told you that, and I've told the RNC that. But we haven't seen the schedule yet. You know, I got a life here, Madam Chairwoman. We've got to get a schedule.
We're slow rolling it. We are slow rolling the schedule a little. There's a lot of reasons why. I mean, contractually, it's hard with some of these venues. It'll speed up. It'll speed up after the first debate. I want you to be part of a debate too.
So, we want 10. I don't want one. I want 10. I love the first. I love the way you're going about this. It's finally, Reince got it started, and you've got it perfected along with David Bossie and the committee. But when do you think we'll see that schedule?
I think there'll be a debate announced per debate. I don't think you're going to see a whole schedule. I think we're going to see debate after debate, and there's reasons for that. I'm not going to relay all of that on the air, but there's reasons for us. It helps us negotiate by not having it all out at once, and I think we get better say in moderators and other things and networks and what they're going to give when we are slow rolling it a little bit.
Yeah, well, hey, we had to make media had to adjust when last time around 2015-16. CNBC threw John Harwood on there, and then they got exiled. And that's a good threat to keep over people. But I don't agree with some of our candidates who are wanting to eliminate NBC or CNN. I hope you guys aren't listening to that, because it seems to me that they've got to be, if the moderating panel is fine, if it's balanced, it won't matter. What do you think about the objections from candidates to NBC and CNN?
Hearing that from the candidates as much as from, you know, certain conservative media folks. Listen, I think as a party, we have to recognize that the path to the White House runs through independent voters. We have voters migrating. Republican voters are migrating to red states, go figure, because of low taxes and the schools were open during the pandemic. So Florida, Texas, Tennessee, they're getting redder. But the path to the White House runs through blue and purple states, which means we have to get in front of these independent voters. And I think that starts now. So I want good moderators. I don't want a moderator that's going to be a Democrat attacking our candidate. But I do think we have to expand our reach, and it can't just be through conservative media outlets.
Now, let me talk to you about production values on the debates. I'm sure you watched the Twitter announcement of Governor DeSantis, and he did great. Twitter didn't do so great. If that happens to an RNC debate, we lose half the audience in 5 minutes. How much do production values matter to the RNC when they're making debate choices?
It does matter. I mean, we don't want the microphones not to work. You don't want the candidate, one candidate to get a microphone that works and one that doesn't. Or there's a whole bunch of things that go into production. What your listeners probably don't even know is the RNC doesn't pay for the debates. The networks do. And it's an expensive process.
Very.
But by doing this in a slow way, we're able to negotiate better with these networks. We didn't hand it all out at once. Like, we didn't give them all the candy at once. We're saying, let's see how you're doing. Let's see what your coverage is like. We want to see a CNN town hall and how that goes with Nikki Haley and Donald Trump. So we're watching the process as it goes. But we want to have that negotiation power. And part of that is not announcing all the debates at once.
Coming up, a dangerous and provocative move on our naval warship in the Taiwan Strait.
Not only is this unsafe, it's unprofessional, and it sort of demonstrates a lack of proficiency, a lack of training on the part of the Chinese. And the fact that they won't sit down and meet with our Secretary of Defense shows that they believe that they don't have to.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Stay with us.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. On Saturday last week, a Chinese warship engaged in what our military calls, quote, an unsafe maritime interaction. I call it cutting them off. It was the second provocation, a major one, in the span of a week from the CCP. It was yet another reminder of our new reality. China senses American weakness and is looking to capitalize on less than assertive leadership coming from the Biden administration. We had better wake up quickly. I turned to retired Navy captain and historian Henry Hendricks. In March of this year, Hendricks wrote an important piece for The Atlantic. The title, The Age of American Naval Dominance is Over. So you have talked to me for years about the possibility of a, quote, shouldering incident, close quote. Would you explain what that is? And then also, in the context of this weekend's incident, do you think Lloyd Austin was watching in real time the head of Paycom? What was going on back at the White House Situation Room as we approach near miss with a Chinese vessel?
Well, Hugh, you know, these Taiwan Transit Strait procedures, these maneuvers that we do these repeatedly. We do these, you know, anywhere between 4 to 6 times a year just to demonstrate that we consider those waters to be international. But we know that when it happens, it's going to excite the Chinese. They do not want us there. They believe that those are their internal waters. Obviously, they claim Taiwan, so they believe the strait between the two. So I have no doubt that, for instance, Admiral Aquilino, the commander of Indo-PACOM, was watching this in real-time video coming off the ship because it's just that level. And I'm sure that the teletype going between Indo-PACOM and then the Situation Room in the White House was probably alive with each moment of how things were going, because these things are monitored that way. So very unsafe maneuver, passing within 150 yards. In fact, an unprofessional maneuver, and this is something that ship drivers look at. Not only is this unsafe, it's unprofessional, and it sort of demonstrates a lack of proficiency, a lack of training on the part of the Chinese. Note that this is, you know, we do these repeatedly. This is not even the most unsafe the Chinese have been. In fact, in 2018, they cut off the USS Decatur. They came within 43 yards of her and caused her to go all back with that. I think that's actually one of the reasons why it's kind of interesting. We use the ship Chung Hoon is one of the two ships that is sunk in Jim Stavridis's 2034 novel that begins the World War III scenario there. So this is something that we see happening repeatedly. And by the way, the Chinese have a real a fear of this particular ship. It's named after our first Asian American admiral, Gordon Chung Hoon, who was a graduate of the Naval Academy prior to World War II and commanded the destroyer Sigsby in the war. And he won the Navy Cross and the Silver Star. The Chinese think that we actually used the USS Chung Hoon to deliberately embarrass them in the region, highlighting the great service of Asian Americans in our Navy. So they really sort of get really sensitized when Chung Hoon shows up, because they think that we're sort of deliberately poking him in the eye. So, but anyways, these processes and procedures are normal. What we've seen is them becoming increasingly aggressive. And in fact, I've noted that they've designed a new ship, the Type 55 Cruiser, which is 11,500 tons. She's bigger than our destroyers. She has a long, what I call a slab side, a flat side. I believe that ship has been designed specifically to be able to come out and shoulder us, where we actually make contact between the two ships, and they use their greater mass to shove us out of the way. This is something that the Soviets did on a couple of occasions during the Cold War, 1988 in particular, in the Black Sea. They actually came out and made contact with one of our Spruance-class destroyers at the time and tried to move it out of the waters that they were claiming there in the Black Sea. So I believe that this incident is coming, that that we will have a shouldering situation. And if they don't handle it professionally, if they can't drive their ships well, then in fact, that could be a collision that could result in the loss of life. None of us want to see that level of unprofessionalism resulting in that type of a disaster.
Cap Hendricks, had there been contact, what would have been the result in your professional estimate?
Well, given the angle of the approach there, and mind you, 150 yards, you know, we weren't there, and we had slowed. So I know that they took our ship, reduced her speed down to maintain separation. But had they come in and deliberately tried to make contact with that type of angle, you could have seen a puncturing of the hulls of both ships, letting seawater in, resulting in loss of life, damage to machinery. That is what none of us want to see. But the Chinese are reacting in a very emotional way. And you saw this with the speech given by their defense minister, where he calls these operations, which are normal operations in international waters, he's calling them deliberately provocative and escalatory. And he's doing that in the presence of Lloyd Austin at a defense conference overseas. So it's very clear they want us to back off. And the fact that they won't sit down and meet with our Secretary of Defense shows that they believe that they don't have to. And that disturbs me a lot, that they're beginning to view us as the supplicant. And we've allowed that to happen because we've allowed our Navy to shrink in size and our presence to be reduced.
Coming up, a closer look at non-prosecutorial DAs.
They realize that it's the prosecutor who's the gatekeeper to the criminal justice system. It's not the mayor, it's not city council, it's not the governor, it's not the sheriff, it's the DA, the prosecutor.
From the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy celebrates our 25th anniversary year, please watch our new promotional video based on Ronald Reagan's 1976 radio address, Shaping the World for 100 Years to Come, on our Pepperdine SPP YouTube channel. And if you know someone who's thinking about graduate school this fall, we welcome applications at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. That's publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Going back for nearly a decade now, we have seen a distressing and corrosive development moving through the American criminal justice system. It's the rise and the proliferation of non-prosecutorial DAs. That is, prosecutors who simply will not prosecute. Our cities are far less safe and the criminal class has been emboldened. Callie Stimson of the Heritage Foundation writes about it in his new book, Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. He joined Larry O'Connor on the Salem News Channel.
So I know you've been walking down the path of writing a book.
We have, and it was a labor of love or hate because, I mean, it really was a topic that needed to be explored in depth. And so our blog posts and our legal memoranda and our symposia were fine, but we really wanted to dig deep, Larry, into the origins, playbook, and beliefs of this movement, and then dig into the specific policies and the impact of these pro-criminal, anti-victim policies in eight particular cities. And then we wanted to follow the money. So we have a whole chapter on the money. And Great. So it took 10 months to write it. It's a long book. It's heavily footnoted. And we're looking forward to its release.
So let's talk specifically about what this means. I love the fact that you call them prosecutors, because depending on what jurisdiction you're in, district attorney, commonwealth attorney, state's attorney, their job is to prosecute criminals. That's the job, prosecute criminals. And when they get elected, these guys, generally speaking, they do the opposite. They don't get into the job to put people behind bars.
Right. And there are 2,300 elected DAs across the country. And the ingenious, devilish aspect of this movement, which is very well funded and started in 2016, as we chronicle in our book, is that they realize that it's the prosecutor who's the gatekeeper to the criminal justice system. It's not the mayor. It's not the city council. It's not the governor, not the sheriff. It's the DA, the prosecutor. And so these are low visibility, low dollar races for the most part, except in the big cities. And even there, they're low dollar politically wise. And so they decided to just flip this narrative and swap out a law and order DA, whether they're a Democrat or Republican is irrelevant, with a pro-criminal, anti-victim zealot. And that's what they've done. And although we highlight eight individual chapters, there's 70 plus across the country. And that represents over 60% of the population of this country. So it's a scourge across this country.
Yeah, and it's so contrary to how most Americans think our government runs. You know, you elect your representatives, they go to the state capitol, they debate and write legislation. If they vote on it and the governor signs it, then it becomes law. These guys basically go in there and under the guise of prosecutorial discretion, they just ignore the law. So why go through the messy business of actually legislating when you can just ignore it and still get your goals?
Yeah, they're abusing their office. They engage in prosecutorial nullification. And we have good criminal justice systems across this country, 18,000 police departments, 2,300 elected DAs, 3,143 counties. But we have an adversarial criminal justice system, which is better than the rest around the world, and we pit a hard-charging, ethical, fair prosecutor against an hard-charging, ethical, fair, aggressive public defender or criminal defense attorney, put him in front of a judge and let the jury sort it out. But they believe, this movement, that they believe the entire criminal justice system is racist. Obviously, it's not. And they believe that the only way to change that paradigm is to, quote, reverse engineer and dismantle, unquote, the criminal justice system as we know it. Those are their words, not ours. And so they are just swapping out law and order DAs for pro-criminal, anti-victim zealots. And the crime has exploded in those cities. And, of course, it hurts the very people they pretend to care the most about, which are minorities.
You actually have George Soros' name in your subtitle, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. Is this really, do all roads really do lead to George Soros on this? Was he sort of the origination of this strategy?
So we thought so when we were first writing about this, but what we found out in the research for our book is it was really an idea hatched between a Soros employee and an ACLU employee, Whitney Tymas and Chloe Cockburn. And they met at a Panera here in Washington, D.C. to try to unseat pro-death penalty elected DAs in the South. They knocked off three of them with Soros money, and then they decided to go big, and they went after Anita Alvarez, who was the Democrat female elected DA in Chicago. They primaried her with Kim Fox and then decided to go national. And so this was funded by Soros and then Carrie Tuna, Dustin Moskovitz of Facebook, and some other tech billionaires. And again, these are low-dollar affairs. $1 million goes a long way in a DA's race.
Yeah. But the repercussions are enormous, and that's the other part of your book here. The jury's in now on this. There's no guesswork. Oh, gosh, what will happen? We've seen it. What cities have been devastated the most by this new approach just in the last, what, 6-7 years?
Yeah, Los Angeles, obviously. Philadelphia has one of the most evil, despicable rogue prosecutors in Larry Krasner. Homicides almost doubled under his watch. Rapes, carjackings. It's a carjacking capital of the United States now. Chicago under Kim Fox, the first rogue prosecutor. Kim Gardner in St. Louis was just resigned in disgrace. Rachel Rollins, the DA in Boston, who was the U.S. attorney for Massachusetts, who just resigned in disgrace under an ethical crowd and should have been prosecuted, by the way, by the DOJ. Marilyn Mosby up the street in Baltimore. And then Chesa Boudin, the son of the Weather Underground in San Francisco, who was recalled in disgrace by Democratic voters. And that the sad part of this story, Larry, is it didn't need to happen. The criminal justice systems across the country have been reforming themselves for years and are the reason that crime has been going down dramatically across the country since its last spike in 1992. But when these guys come into office starting in 2016, crime in those cities explodes.
Well, and with each and every one of those prosecutors you just mentioned, and I would add Steve Descano here in Fairfax County in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and Buddha Bibberai in Loudoun County, they just have to win the Democrat nomination. That's it. I hate to be cynical, but that's the case. So are enough Democrats stepping up? Do they see the problem? Are reasonable Democrats coming in challenging, and actually do they have a chance?
Big time. Big time. And in fact, we quote and interviewed mostly Democrats in the inner city for this book, including city council members. One in particular, Andrew Lara, is a Pico Rivera city council, which I know you know, Rivera,
Southern California,
from the L.A. area. And he said that these rogue prosecutors are, quote, ruining our brand, unquote, because, you know, law and order should not be a partisan issue. And so it's the Democrats who voted these people into office, and it's been the Democrats who beat them on recall elections or in primaries. And I think people are just starting to see that these so-called reformers are actually nightmares in office, and so they got to get rid of them.
You can catch Larry at thesalemnewschannel.com and via our app on Roku. Coming up, we'll return once again to the presidential contest taking shape right now.
Isn't it contradistinctions between the Republicans and Democrats? I mean, who do the Democrats have?
In the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Tuning into the baseball game, monitoring the incoming storm, catching your favorite talk show. These are just a few of the reasons more than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month. And did you know AM radio is the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping us safe in dangerous times? It's reliable, free, and public safety depends on it. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress we need AM radio in cars. This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It would be difficult to overstate the importance of the 2024 election. Up and down the ticket. The GOP majority in the House is on the ballot. The contest for control of the Senate is close. Of course, the contest for who will take the oath of office as President of the United States on January 20th, 2025. Stephen Moore joined Dan Prof and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer, in Chicago.
These candidates that are entering the race for the presidency on the Republican side, Pence, Christie, and also North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. And I know people don't know much about him outside of North Dakota, but got some talent in the Republican field for presidential for the presidential nomination, too.
Yeah, you sure do. And you know, isn't it in contradistinction between the Republicans and the Democrats? I mean, who do the Democrats have? They're going to run a guy who, you know, incapable of really, I can't imagine five more years of Joe Biden. And then who's their second choice? Kamala Harris, really? I mean, she's the most hated woman in America. And then, you know, you got Governor Hairgel there in California, who's the only thing good about him is his hair. And he's got beautiful hair, I got to admit. But then on the Republican side, you've got Tim Scott, who I love, is the senator from South Carolina, is talking a lot about opportunity, about school choice, about, you know, making America an opportunity society again. And that's so much in the vein of what America is all about. And I love Ron DeSantis. He's been one of the best governors in America. By the way, can I say, you may have heard, Dan and Amy, that Trump is running these ads, these malicious ads against DeSantis, saying that even Cuomo had a better record of dealing with COVID than DeSantis, which is a total lie. And, you know, I'm a Trump fan. I work for the guy. But this is a lie. DeSantis handled COVID about as well as any state. They didn't shut down their economy. And by the way, if you adjust for age, because obviously there are a lot of senior citizens living in Florida, Florida had a lower death rate than New York did, and yet New York completely shut down their economy and their schools.
But then you have Chris Christie, and I don't know if you know him personally, but I mean,
what's
the
that
thought,
about?
The first GOP debate is going to be in August, and I mean, I'll have to watch it for work, but I don't want to watch it because it's just going to be ugly, and it's not going to help the party, I don't think.
Well, the big question, of course, Dan and Amy, is will Donald Trump show up?
Oh,
you know, he's been threatening that he might not debate. So we'll see. I mean, you know, he so dominates these debates when he does appear, you know, when he did it in 2015 and 16. So, but look, my point is, I'm not sold on Trump. I mean, I work for him. I have an admiration for what he did for our economy. But I want to see all of these guys. I want to see him on the stage. I want to let the best man or woman. There's a lot of people like Nikki Haley. I know Nikki a little bit. I think she's a great candidate. So it's a good field of really established people.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you've benefited from what we're doing, mention it to a friend, please. Go to townhallreview.com to sign up for our podcast. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers David Bouchon, Tim Gantner, Adam Ramsey, and, of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us on the Town Hall Review.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.